Hello, friends. Welcome to the End Evil podcast. Evil is the destruction of freedom. This podcast is dedicated to the book, The End of All Evil, by Jeremy Locke. If you'd like to get a copy of that book, head on over to endevil.life and you'll find a link on the sidebar. And I'd also say when you're there, it'd be a good thing to sign up for the email newsletter list, because there are going to be some special thing events coming up that are going to be for folks that have signed up for the newsletter on my website. So go ahead and do that and subscribe to the YouTube channel if you haven't. All those things are awesome, wonderful things to do. But more importantly, we want to get out in the world and work towards freedom, which, you know, we got a long way to go. There's a lot of hell going on around us, and a lot of problems, a lot of misunderstandings. So I've been working my way through trying to simplify, to understand and explain natural law and freedom and truth to folks here on the End Evil podcast for 4 years now. And I've been working real hard recently on a book that I'm looking to publish this summer. So this week I'm sharing with you some readings of chapters as I'm working on them in the book. And I'm going to play that for you. Some little recordings I've been making in the mornings, like on the way to work. I live in a beautiful, amazing place, and you're about to see that. So without any more ado, I'm going to play for you. I called this episode The Battlefield. That's only one of the chapters I'm reading. I'm actually going to be reading 3 chapters, but thanks for joining me, Sarah Cross and MCAD, Colby and Monica out there in Oregon, and Leslie. Appreciate it, folks. It's always fun to see you in the chat. Anybody else out there, feel free to jump in the chat and hang with us while we watch the rest of this show. And I'm going to turn myself off and turn the show on. Thanks for coming, folks.
Hello, this is Chris Jansen. Welcome to the End Evil podcast.
What is holding you back from doing the things you want to do in life, from feeling the way you want to feel, from achieving the goals that you secretly desire? What do you desire? You know, a lot of our thought process in life, we don't realize, gets programmed really early on. And we forget that we have to stop and question and doubt some of the fundamentals that were set in our life really early on. Often this is done through various systems of control, like school. School has a way of indoctrinating people and getting them used to this authoritarian Skinner type punishment reward system, where you're supposed to do what you're told or else you're going to receive a punishment. And we go on in life kind of treating ourselves that way. It sets up a belief system. And then beyond that, we have various cultural religions, all kinds of family traditions to stick to certain faiths and storylines that come from old books. And there's wisdom in many of these cultural religions and traditions. However, most times belief systems are deadly, and they offer a way for people to betray their own inner conscience, what they know is actually right, and do what they're told in many situations because they believe in a system of belief, which is a religion. It's something that binds you, and it puts you in a position of making choices you might not otherwise make. So this chapter from the book I'm working on, called The Book That Changed My Life, is called The Hell of Belief. And it's kind of a lot of my personal history, because I was in the Christian church when I was a kid. And I learned a lot about the Bible, and my dad was a preacher.
And that stuff all really stuck with me for many years. And it's taken me a lifetime to sort it all out and see which parts of it I like and make sense and which parts of it are dogmatic and are causing a problem in my thought process. So I had to read books that actually spoke counter to what I was taught when I was a kid and weigh both of them against each other and use my own methods of divining truth to decide what makes most sense. And that's what I'm hoping you do. And this chapter is meant to encourage people to not fall into the traps of various religions. It's called The Hell of Belief. Martin Luther. Most people just know the surface. A Catholic monk nailed his 95 theses to the church door. He kicked off the Protestant Reformation. One step in deeper, and you see the real weight of what he did. Luther wasn't just protesting indulgences. He was calling out an entire machine. The Catholic Church at that time was the gatekeeper of God. They dictated who got to read scripture, who had access to divine knowledge. They told people salvation had a price tag. Luther snapped the chain. He translated the Bible into German so that everyday people, farmers, blacksmiths, mothers, could read it for themselves. That was rebellion at its rawest. He said, "You are not only responsible for what you say, but also for what you do not say." And he lived that, putting himself in the crosshairs to break the monopoly on truth. But the cost was real. You dig into history and you'll find names like William Tyndale burned alive for translating the Bible into English. Men and women hunted down, tortured, killed, just for sharing information, just for letting others see with their own eyes. Truth throughout history has always come with a price tag. The question is, who's willing to pay it? That's where my own path cracked wide open. I grew up like a lot of folks, Bible stories, sermons, thinking Christianity was the sacred, untouchable thing. But the more I learned, the more I couldn't stomach the blood on its hands. The Crusades, the Inquisitions, wars, tortures, conquest, all done under the banner of the same cross that I had pledged loyalty to. And yeah, there are powerful words in the Bible. Jesus preaching love and forgiveness, challenging the corrupt. But how do you reconcile that with centuries of violence carried out in his name or in the name of the same book? For me, I hit a point where I couldn't pretend that the institution was the same as the message. I didn't want to be associated with a system that traded lives for power while preaching peace at the same time. Christianity was one layer of the onion that led me to questioning everything, because it led to a deeper question. How do we know a story is true? Who wrote it? Who edited it? Who burned the libraries and controlled the printing presses after? And more importantly, when is it ever wrong to question a story? You look at history, and it's full of people who suffered, died, vanished, all because they dared to ask those same questions. Truth has always threatened empires. That's why Zachariah Sitchin's work grabbed me. Sure, he gets dismissed by mainstream scholars, but the guy spent years decoding ancient Sumerian tablets, cross-referencing them with biblical texts, digging into stories older than most civilizations. He didn't swallow the official narrative. He looked at the myths, gods descending from the skies, shaping human destiny, and asked, what if this just wasn't just an allegory? What if the stories we inherited here are fragments of something deeper, something deliberately hidden? Sitchin once said, what's important is not to let the establishment dictate what should be known and what should not. Let me say that again. What's important is not to let the establishment dictate what should be known and what should not. That hit me hard, because once you start peeling back layers, you see it everywhere. Someone's always trying to decide for you what's acceptable truth. And when you look back at Luther, Tyndale, Sitchin, they all had something in common. They weren't content with the story they were handed. They knew the cost, but they spoke out anyway. Luther said, peace is possible. Peace, if possible, truth at all costs. Peace, if possible, truth at all costs. So here's the takeaway. It's not about swapping one story for the other. It's not about waking up to the fact that every belief system, every history book, every institution wants to hand you a script. Your job is to question who wrote it, who benefits from it, what's being left out. Because truth doesn't need permission. It doesn't care about authority. It shows up for the ones brave enough to ask better questions and to keep asking even when it burns. So I'll ask you, what stories are you ready to tear apart? And what are you willing to risk to find out what's real? You know, having the book that changed my life is kind of not just a opportunity, but it's a threat. It's telling you that if you go down certain roads of thought and discovery, you will change your life. So I really kind of wrestle with that idea of trying to claim my book's going to change someone's life. So that's why I call it the book that changed my life, because I know it's changing my life by going through the process of writing it, because it's a scary thing to put something out in the world and stand behind it fully. So that's kind of why I'm putting so much time and energy and effort into reading over these chapters, sharing them with you friends, and getting feedback and making sure that they really do provide that opportunity if someone so chooses to change their life. And it is possible, but you're going to have to dig deeper, and you're going to have to probably turn over some stones that you don't want to in your belief systems. And that's a hard process, and only you can figure out what it takes to do that. But until you do, those belief systems will keep you imprisoned. I know, because I've been there. All right, folks, hope you have a wonderful day. I hope this talk brought you something to mull on and open some doors and thoughts in your mind about. And here's to the journey. Just stopped to read another chapter from this book I've been working on. Nice sunny day with some wonderful weather engineering chemtrails going on here. There's a lot of things to wake up to in this world that are grim realities that are kind of hard to face. And one of those is weather engineering. It was one of those things that really changed my perspective on everything and kind of led towards me finding this passion for sharing the important aspects of life with other people. I think it's far too easy in the modern world for life to get lost in the details and the problems, the traumas, the everyday grind, trying to make the money, trying to make the bills, trying to seek pleasure. These things keep us in a whirlwind of distraction. And I've realized that part of my work here is to find some grounding and help share with others what I've come to realize are the things in life that really do bring some more solid foundations in terms of what are we doing here? What is our passion? What is our purpose? Why? And how are we going to feel good about the life we lived when we get to the end of it? And that's what I'm offering to you folks, is an opportunity to put some words and thoughts and ideas out there that might grab a hold of you in your own thought process. And when you lay down at night and think about what do you want to do with your time in this life and what's truly important to you. This chapter I'm going to read you now is called The Rocky Path. I'm just taking some chapters out of the book I'm working on, not in order, just kind of how they grab a hold of me and seem like, oh, this is a good topic for today, and I'll print it out. And then reading it out loud is a good way to sort of spell check and see how it sounds. And I'm also giving you an opportunity to make comments, and it might improve this book before I even publish it, having some good opinions and ideas from other people, because I really do want to create that conduit for change, that opportunity for people to reanalyze things. And it's up to each of us to do that. But, you know, I can provide a window or a door, an opportunity. So this is called Rocky Path. Picture yourself on a trail. Not the smooth, well-marked kind, but one of those wild, twisting paths. You know the type. Rocks loose under your feet, cliffs dropping off the side. The kind of trail where every step demands your full attention. Life's exactly like that. It's got blind corners, steep climbs, sudden drops, and every now and then you hit a clearing and the view punches you in the chest. Beautiful. Brutal, real. But when you're on the hard parts, the dark valleys, the sheer walls, you forget that there's a bigger view. You get tunnel vision. It's easy to lock in on the stress, the grief, the chaos right in front of you. Seneca said it best, we suffer more in imagination than in reality. And when the trauma hits, when the ground disappears beneath you, your imagination starts spinning worst case scenarios on repeat. You can't see past the weight sitting on your chest. Take the loss of someone you love. It feels like hauling yourself up a slope that never ends, every step dragging a little heavier. Or maybe it's a relationship falling apart, something you've built your life around suddenly gone. That's the kind of drop-off that'll knock the wind out of you. Feels like you're standing at the bottom of a cold, empty canyon. Climbing back out feels impossible. But whether you can see it or not, that trail keeps going. The sun still rises. The horizon's still there. Or maybe it's your health. Yours or someone close. Illness, injury, something creeping in that knocks you sideways. You find yourself navigating a path you didn't sign up for, or you don't think you did. Every step uncertain. Or maybe it's financial, job loss, bills stacking like a wall, the ground beneath you crumbling. It feels like standing on the edge of a cliff. Nowhere to turn. But even there, there's always something to hold on to. It might be small. It might feel shaky, but it's there. You just have to reach. We are never truly alone. And don't forget the smaller stuff, family fights, stress at work, even the things society tells you should be blessings, like marriage or raising kids. All of it comes with its own sharp edges, its own unexpected curves. Life doesn't hand out clean, predictable paths. It's peaks and valleys, always. Emotional chaos in our modern age is predictable. But here's the thing. The difference between falling and moving forward, what you lean on and what you learn from. Every step you take, you need something solid, something grounded. That's where your principles come in. They're like that walking stick, the one you plant firmly into the ground when the trail turns rough. It's not there for decoration. It's there to keep you balanced when everything else is slipping out from underneath you. Every step you take, you need something solid. Yeah, that's the walking stick. It's there to keep you balanced when everything else is slipping out in front of you. And those principles, they're not something you make up on the fly. They're written into reality, like tools forged and left there, waiting for anyone willing to use them. Truth, morality, natural law. They're lifelines. If you choose to grab hold, tattoos for your mind, symbols for your walking stick. The trap, though, is getting stuck. Trauma narrows your vision. You stop seeing the bigger picture. You stop recognizing that the trail keeps winding. Epictetus put it bluntly. We cannot choose our external circumstances, but we can always choose how we respond to them. That's where your freedom lives, not in controlling the chaos, but in controlling yourself within it. Most people fall back on old patterns, survival modes hardwired since childhood, react, avoid, numb out. But if you keep walking that same circle, you're going to trip over the same stones again and again. Real strength is about rewiring, reshaping how you move, expanding perspective, sharpening mental tools, learning to stop and see the big picture ever so often, to keep things in perspective and context. Look around. It's not just you carrying that weight. The numbers on emotional stress, anxiety, depression, they're staggering. Over 50 million adults in this country fighting mental illness. That's not a coincidence. We're walking through a time where the load's been deliberately piled on. Family breakdown, rising divorce rates, 40 to 50% of marriages ending, kids torn apart from families, and that's just the visible part. The darkness lurking beneath, human trafficking, children disappearing, lives shattered. It's beyond numbers. You don't see headlines about it, but it's there. It's real. And the people in power, the ones supposed to protect, more often than not, they're the ones feeding the machine. It's no wonder people want to check out, curl inward, stay stuck in fear. But here's where the rubber meets the road. We've been handed a task. Most people don't want to look at this task. Because once you see it, you can't unsee it. The world is broken. But you can't fix anything if your eyes are only glued to the dirt at your feet or the wounds on your own hands and body. You've got to lift your gaze. You got to see past the immediate struggle, past the valley walls closing in, past the noise designed to keep you small. The trail is brutal, no doubt, but principles keep you standing. Resilience keeps you moving. And the knowledge that it's not just about surviving for yourself, it's about showing others how to find their footing too. You can't control what life throws at you, but you can control whether you keep walking. What you learn from the past conflicts, fires, and pain, whether you carry the torch, light the path, and remind the ones stumbling behind you that there's something bigger ahead. Your walking stick of principles carries you forward like Gandalf, knowing that your part in it all is unique and necessary as it is strange. And when the time comes, you are ready to set your staff down firmly and draw your line in the sand. So stand up like Gandalf, you know. Really, a lot of what I'm writing about is trying to motivate folks to even be in the place where they want to seek change, because I think we all know deep down that real change, big deep change in ourselves, is not an easy process. It's difficult. But I don't think there's anything in life that can bring you more joy and purpose than doing something bigger and greater than just your own self and desire. And you know that. Your heart knows that. So what are you doing with your time and your life? Is it something that 10 or 20 years later you're going to look back and know that it was something really valuable, not just for yourself, but for the others? Or is your entire energy and focus in just surviving or just trying to feel good? You know, these are the hard questions that I'm hoping that you can ask yourself. I hope that these words bring some sort of inspiration or change to your life. And I'd love to see your comments or thoughts on this talk. And we'll see you next time, folks. Have a good day. I've been enjoying sharing some parts of this book I've been writing. I've been writing a book. The book I'm writing is called The Book That Changed My Life. And I know it's going to be a life-changing experience for me, publishing my first book. And that should be happening this summer. But I'm still working on some of the chapters and going through some thought processes. So I encourage, if you're listening to this, share with me your thoughts on this topic. This topic is called The Battlefield. Beautiful day. Doesn't look much like a battlefield out here. It's about as peaceful as it gets, other than the Walmart truck roaring down the freeway there. But there is a quiet, subtle, latent violence that's going all around us all the time in our world we're in. We're living in a mental, spiritual battlefield. It's not an easy time to be alive in many ways. And not to be saying that people in history and other times haven't been through worse. I think most of the stories I've read, and I've been reading a lot about World War II recently, people going through horrific, terrible things that it's hard for me to imagine in the physical realm. But most of the battlefield we're facing, you and I, those of us that are dealing with today, 2025, are it's an emotional and a spiritual warfare that's going on all the time around us. And how do we deal with that? How do we defend against that? This chapter in my book is about mental, spiritual self-defense. And I do think physical self-defense is really important too. And that's something I like to talk about in future sessions like this. But today, for the sake of this conversation, this is about our inner self and our relationships with people. I printed out this chapter. I'm going to read it to you in a minute. But before I start it, I just wanted to mention a couple things. I'm planning the first Monday of next month to do a special End Evil Podcast Connect meeting, where folks like yourself might want to meet with me and other like-minded thinkers. And if you're interested in such a mastermind meeting, it's really going to be aimed for people that want to be part of the content creation process, or hell, the freedom manifestation process. If you're sick of seeing the world the way it is and you want to be part of the change, I'm one of those people that's encouraging to work in that direction. But I'm the longer I've been doing this work, the more I've realized that we're not really emotionally and spiritually prepared for any kind of actual battle in the real world, because we don't have our principles straight and we're not on the same page, and people are having trouble relating in the most simple ways. Somehow these devices and apps seem to confound communication more than anything else. I see a lot of division between people that should be in agreement in theory, and I think it's due to lack of emotional intelligence and maturity. And I'm not saying I'm perfect. I got a long ways to go. But the more anybody does their own self inner work and philosophy and understanding of principles, the easier it is to see the problems and to become conscious of them. So the first thing I wanted to talk about before I read this is that if you've heard of Marshall Rosenberg and NVC, or nonviolent communication, I've noticed a lot of people are very, they're very critical of the method, and I can understand why. When the method is applied forcefully onto someone, like, oh, you need to talk this way, that can be offensive. That being said, I think it's a very powerful formula I've gathered from understanding Rosenberg's work, and so I bring that up in this chapter. And I hope you can understand that the way I'm using it is an internal process, and I don't really think it's a good idea to try to make other people use certain words or talk the way you're talking. I don't think that's going to work. But he's had some pretty amazing encounters, and the guy had been into some pretty tight situations if you read his book and read about him. So
you know, it is very interesting putting himself into very intense situations where people are ready to kill each other almost, and he managed to broker some sort of peace in many of these situations, according to his story. So the other thing I wanted to mention is that I do like to burn sage, or I have these little Palo Santo sticks, and I keep those like in my little hangout spot at home, and then sometimes I have it in my car. And when I'm going through things, sometimes I do burn a little sage or Palo Santo, or just kind of like important times to me where it's just like, oh, now's a good moment, I should do that. And I look sometimes at a tarot card, and I don't like make life decisions off these moments, but they're like a little flavor. So I made fun of burning sage a little bit in the first paragraph here, and that's why I was mentioning that. I'm not saying I'm opposed to it. I think burning sage or Palo Santo is a great thing, but I'm trying to get real in this chapter and not be all too far on the mystical woo-woo side. And those of you that are that way, you know, I think it's a good practice to work on being a little more left brain and logical. And then the people that are super left brain and logical, we need to work a little more on recognizing the mystical and strange aspects of life and the world. And there's a lot of mystical synchronicity connections, if you see my last talk on synchronicities. So this is called Battlefield. Mental and spiritual defense. Mental and spiritual self-defense isn't about lighting sage and hoping for good vibes. It's about protecting your internal terrain like it's a sacred ground in a war zone. You got noise coming at you from every direction. Media, trauma, toxic relationships, your own damn inner critic. And if you're not actively defending your mind and your spirit, you're just waiting to be overrun. Own your inner battlefield. Step one, stop outsourcing your peace. Stop blaming your job, your partner, your upbringing. You can't always control what happens, but you do control what takes root in your mind. Emotional discipline isn't about stuffing things down. It isn't about tracking your reactions. No, it is about tracking your reactions, feeling them fully, and still choosing your next move with precision. Anger, let it talk, but don't let it drive. Fear, listen to what it's warning you about, but don't bow to it. If you can hold your center when everything inside you wants to lash out or shut down, you're already 90% ahead of most people walking this earth. Or you're already ahead of 90% of the people that are walking this earth. Relationships are mirrors into your soul. Let's talk about relationships. Because your mental and your spiritual armor is only tested and proved in the fires of relating to others, close relationships, and long-term dealings with other beings. If someone constantly drains you, disrespects you, or throws their emotional garbage at your feet, that's not love. That's sabotage. That doesn't mean you ghost everyone who rubs you wrong. It means you start using discernment like a blade. Who's lifting you? Who's bleeding you? Who's just reflecting back your own unhealed wounds? Here's where you really have to ask yourself, what is triggering you and causing your emotions to swim or spiral out of control? Do you have obstacles that are slowing down your process of forgiveness, understanding, and empathy? Of course you do. And so do we all. Yet we must face these demons within, or they will quietly rule and convince you there's not a problem, and that it's everyone else that is the problem. Do you know anyone else who does this? Are you showing up real, or are you shape-shifting to avoid conflict, begging for scraps of approval? Mental self-defense means no more pretending to be okay with what breaks you. You want real peace? Then start demanding real honesty. First from yourself, then from everyone else. NVC and the war inside your head. Here's a tool I use often, especially when I feel like snapping. It's called nonviolent communication, developed by Marshall Rosenberg, a man who walked into some of the most hostile places on the planet with nothing but a marker and a method. His goal? Break through the static of human conflict by getting people to actually listen to themselves and each other, to recognize their needs. Now, I'm not here to romanticize the guy. The NVC world can get lost in its own feel-good jargon. Some folks weaponize empathy like it's a control tactic. But at its core, the method is legit, especially when you turn it inward. I use a streamlined version I call IFNR. Well, that's what Rosenberg calls it as well. Information, feelings, needs, request. Go through this process in your own mind. Information, what actually happened? Strip away your story, just the raw, observable facts. Feelings, what are you really feeling? Name it, own it. No justifications, no armor. Needs, what's underneath this feeling? What vital need is being ignored or stepped on? And request. Now that you've got clarity, what are you asking for? Not a demand, a request, a bridge. What would you ask for if you could? Trying to get someone else to do this, good luck. Most people are too busy defending their pride to reflect on their own wounds. But when I do this inside my own mind, I walk away clear, less reactive, less confused. I stop spinning in circles and I start aiming with purpose. It's not a magic spell, it's a framework. One that you do use like a weapon or a tool, similar to the trivium or the metaphorical tools of the tool belt that I shared with you. That's another chapter in the book, or you can check out Spiritual Mathematics to learn about the tools I'm describing, the metaphorical tools. Quiet, surgical, controlled, and effective. The voice in your head isn't always on your side. You know that voice, the one that says you're not enough, that every failure defines you, that you should just give up, give in, or explode. That voice isn't you, it's a parasite. It's the echo of bad programming, childhood wounds, and old shame. But here's the truth. You can train your internal dialogue. You can call out the lies and replace them with something grounded. Not fake positivity, not spiritual bypassing, just truth. Mental self-defense means tracking those thoughts like threats. You wouldn't let a stranger scream abuse in your face every day, so why would you let your own mind get away with it? Silence isn't peace if it's forced. Let's get something straight. Conflict isn't the enemy. Avoidance is. If you're staying quiet just to keep the peace, you're betraying yourself. If you're not making space for the truth, you're shrinking your soul to fit someone else's comfort zone. Boundaries aren't walls, they're clarity. And clarity is compassion to yourself, to others. If you want spiritual strength, stop ghosting your own inner voice. The eye of the storm is built, not found. How do we hold your center when the world's spinning sideways? You build it. Every damn day, with choices, with practices, with ruthless honesty. Meditation, breath work, dynamic movement, these are tools. But tools only work if you use them. You can't just collect techniques like trophies and expect your life to change. You've got to dig. You've got to be willing to face the truth when it's ugly, when it hurts, and when it makes you want to crawl out of your skin. That's the price of freedom. It's also the reward, the ability to walk through chaos with calm eyes, to speak your truth without flinching, to defend your mind without violence. That's real power. Most people don't even know what they're feeling, let alone how to name it without setting fire to the room. That's where emotional intelligence comes in. Not some soft, polished self-help nonsense, but real internal command, the kind you earn. It's about seeing your emotions like weather patterns in your body, recognizing the storm before you become it, knowing when the thunder's just noise and when it's signaling a real shift. It's the skill of navigating your own internal chaos without dragging everyone around you into the wreckage. At its core, emotional intelligence is self-awareness, self-regulation, motivation, empathy, and basic social skills. In other words, it's knowing what's happening inside of you, choosing how to respond, staying aligned with your goals, feeling other people without losing yourself, and being able to move through relationships without turning them into war zones. It's simple, but not easy. Marshall Rosenberg, yeah, the same guy who walked into violent prisons and got murderers to talk about their feelings, once said, "Peace requires something far more difficult than revenge or even resistance. It requires finding the strength to reconcile." That's emotional intelligence. It's reconciliation, not surrender. Strength, not softness. The good news? You can build it. There are drills, practices. Not just fluffy affirmations, real work. Journaling your emotional patterns. Listening without rehearsing your comeback. Naming your feelings with precision instead of flailing around in blame. Practicing presence like your sanity depends on it, because it does. Mindfulness, meditation, breathwork. Not for enlightenment, but for control, focus, and clarity. You want to train your empathy? Read stories that aren't yours. Sit with people who think differently, and don't flinch. You want to grow your self-awareness? Catch yourself the moment before you react. That moment is the dojo. That's where the battle's won. Emotional intelligence isn't about becoming calm all the time. It's about knowing your inner terrain so well that even your rage has a direction. Even your grief can speak wisdom. It's the internal martial art. It's transcendence. In a world that's constantly baiting you to explode, collapse, or numb out, it's your edge. And that edge, that's yours to sharpen every day. So that's the chapter. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on these ideas and concepts. But I think it's important to remember, even in these peaceful moments, there is a war going on around us for your soul. And unless you choose to be conscious and aware and to find the motivation and the initiative to find that one true path of goodness, you're going to get dragged into the mire. And I just also had one anecdote. I recently had a conversation with Leslie Powers, who has an enormous, amazing history of therapeutic work. And she was explaining to me that she saw some recent models that show that the brain actually, they've mapped some aspects of brain actually goes through our right brain before input comes into the right brain before it goes to other parts of the brain commonly, which means that people make decisions from their emotional places often, because sometimes that's because often, if not more commonly, that's where things start in the mind, in our emotional centers. We have an emotional reaction and then we get a chance to logic it out. So we have to give our mind a chance to work all the way through that process and not get hung up in the beginning. If you take a little time and study marketing, they teach you in marketing and advertising that people make decisions from a place of emotions. And most of us, most people out there are kind of trigger happy with those decision-making process from an emotional place. And it takes a lot of self-work, wisdom, consciousness to not be able to just trigger off of our emotional, whatever grabs us emotionally, and to get into a deeper, more focused, purpose-driven life. And that's what I want to encourage. I'm hoping to reach you, whoever you are. If I could reach myself when I was in my early 20s and help myself realize some things then, I wouldn't have had to go through some of the struggles, you know, into my 30s and 40s. And here I am this year turning 50, and looking forward to the next 50 years. Much love, all. See you on the other side.